flimsy-papered living room of the sixth quarters, Gideon sat staring into a steaming mug of tea. It was grey with the sheer amount of powdered milk stirred into it, and it was her third cup. She had been terribly afraid that they'd put medicines into it, or tranquilizers or something. When she wouldn't drink, both necromancer and cavalier had taken sips to prove it was unadulterated, with expressions that plainly said, "Idiot!" Palamedes had been the one to wait patiently next to her while she had thrown up lavishly in the sixth's toilet. Now she sat, haggard and empty, on a spongy mattress they had pulled out as a chair. Protesilaus's head sat dead-eyed on the desk. It looked exactly as it had in life, as though, upon being separated from its trunk, it had entered into some perfect state of preservation to remain boring forever. It looked about as lively as it had when she'd met him. Palamedes was investigating the white gleam of the spinal column at the nape of the neck for maybe the millionth time. Camilla had shoved a mug of hot tea into Gideon's hands, strapped two swords to her back, and disappeared. This had all happened before Gideon could protest, and now she was left alone with Palamedes, her discovery, and a cluster headache. Things were happening too much. She took a hot mouthful, swilled tea around her teeth, and swallowed mechanically. "She's mine. You've said that 5 times now. I mean it. Whatever goes down, whatever happens, you have to let me do it. You have to." "Gideon." "What do I do?" she said, quite casually, "if she's the murderer?" His interest in the spinal column was not abating. Palamedes had slipped his glasses down his long, craggy nose and was holding the head upside down like he was emptying a piggy bank. He had even shone light into the nose and ears and horrible warp of the throat. "I don't know," he said. "What do you do?" "What would you do if you discovered Camilla was a murderer?" "Help her bury the body," said Palamedes promptly.
"Sextus!"
"I mean it. If Camilla wants someone dead," he said, "then far be it from me to stand in her way. All I can do at that point is watch the bloodshed and look for a mop. One flesh, one end and all that."
"Everyone wants to tell me about fleshes and ends today," said Gideon unhappily.
"There's a joke in there somewhere."
"You're sure there was nothing else along with the head? Bone matter, fingernails, cloth?"
"I checked. I'm not a total tool, Palamedes."
"I trust Camilla. I trust that her reasons for ending someone's life would be logical, moral, and probably to my benefit," he said, sliding one fragile eyelid up an eyeball. "Your problem here is that you suspect that Harrow has killed people for much less. She didn't kill the fourth or fifth. Conjecture, but we'll leave it." "Okay, so," said Gideon, putting her empty mug next to her mattress.
You are now getting the impression that my relationship with her is more fraught than you might have guessed."
"You shock me," muttered Palamedes.
"But that doesn't change the fact that I've known her as long as she's lived, and I thought I knew how far she'd go, because I will tell you for free, she has gone to some intensely shitty lengths, and I guess she's gone to some shittier lengths than I thought concerning me.
But that's the thing. It's me, Sextus. It's always me. She nearly killed me 6 times growing up, but I always knew why."
Palamedes took off his glasses. He finally stopped molesting the head, and he pushed himself up and away from the desk. He sat down heavily on the mattress next to Gideon, skinny knees tucked up into his chest.
"Okay.
Why?" he asked simply.
"Because I killed her parents," said Gideon.
He did not say anything. He just waited. And in the space of that waiting, she talked. And she told him the beginning stuff, how she was born, how she grew up, and how she came to be the primary cavalier of the ninth house, and she told him the secret she had kept for 7 long and awful years.
Heruhark had hated Gideon the moment she clapped eyes on her. But everyone did. The difference was that although most people ignored small Gideon Nav the way you would a turd that had sprouted legs, Tiny Harrow had found her an object of tormentable fascination, prey, rival, and audience all wrapped up in one. And though Gideon hated the Cloisterites, and hated the locked tomb, and hated the ghastly great aunts, and hated Crux most of all, she was hungry for the Reverend Daughter's preoccupation. They were the only two children in a house that was otherwise busy getting gangrene. Everyone acted as though the Emperor had personally resurrected Heruhark just to bring them joy. She had been born healthy and whole, a prodigious necromancer, a perfect penitent nunlet. She was already mounting the ambo and reading out prayers, even as Gideon began desperately praying herself that she might one day go to be an enlisted soldier, which she had wanted ever since Iglamine, the only person Gideon didn't hate all the time, had told her she might be one. The captain had told her stories of the cohort since Gideon was about 3. This was probably the best time of their relationship. Back then they clashed so consistently that they were with each other most of the time. They fought each other bloody, for which Hero was not punished and Gideon was. They set elaborate traps, sieges and assaults, and grew up in each other's pockets, even if it was generally while trying to grievously injure the other one. By the time Hera was 10 years old, she had glutted herself on secrets. She had grown bored of ancient tomes, bored of the bone she had been raising since before she'd finished growing her first set of teeth, and bored of making Gideon run gauntlets of skeletons. At last she set her gaze on the one thing truly forbidden to her. Hera became obsessed with the locked door. There was no key to the locked door. Maybe there had never been a key to the locked door. It simply didn't open. What lay beyond would kill the trespasser before they'd cracked it wide enough to go through anyway, and what lay beyond that, long before ever getting to the tomb, would make them wish they were dead long before their final breath. The nuns dropped to their knees at the mere mention of what was through there. It was the brief delight of Gideon's life that the unnecessarily beatified Heruhark Nona Jesimus chose to ditch her sainthood and unlock it, and that Gideon had been witness to that fact. Out of everyone who found Gideon Nav repellent, Hero's parents had always found her particularly so. They were chilly, joyless Ninth House necromancers, of the type that Silas Octokizeron seemed to think universally inhabited Dreabur, black in heart, power, and appearance. Once, when she had touched a fold of Primehark Nonius Vianus's vestments, he had held her down with skeletal hands and whipped her till she howled. It was only out of the most desperate perversity that she ran straight to them to tell her tale, out of some baffling desire to show some evidence of house loyalty, to absolutely drop Hero in the shit, to get the pat on the head she knew she'd earn for preserving the integrity and the fervid spirit of the house, precisely the qualities she was so ceaselessly accused of lacking. She felt no flicker of guilt or doubt. Just hours before, she'd wrestled Hero down in the dirt, and Hero had scratched until she'd had half of Gideon's face beneath her fingernails. So she told them, and they listened. They had not said a word either in praise or in censure, but they had listened. They had called for Hero, and they had made Gideon leave. She waited outside the great dark doors of their room for a very long time, because they hadn't told her to go away, just go out of the room, and because she was a shitty trash child, she wanted to relish the one chance she had of hearing Heruhark raked over the coals. But she waited a whole hour, and never heard a damn thing, let alone Hero's screams as she was confined to os duty until she turned 30. and then Gideon couldn't wait any more. She pushed open the door and she walked in, and found Pelyamina and Priamhark hanging from the rafters, purple and dead. Mortis the Ninth, their huge and tragic cavalier, swung beside them from a rafter groaning with his bulk, and she walked in on Harrowhark, holding lengths of unused rope among the chairs her parents had kicked aside, with eyes like coals that had burnt away. Harrow had beheld her. She had beheld Harrow. And nothing had ever gone right after that. Never, ever. "I was 11," said Gideon, "and here I am, narking all over again." Palamedes did not say anything. He just sat there, listening as solemnly as if she had described some new type of novel necromantic theorem. Far from feeling cleansed by her impromptu confession, Gideon felt absolutely the opposite, dirty and muddy, terribly exposed, as though she had unbuttoned her chest and given him a good long look at what was inside her ribs. She was garbage from the neck to the navel. She was packed tight with a dry and dusty mould. She had been filled up with it since she was 11, on the understanding that as long as she was attached to the House of the Ninth, she could never make it go away. Gideon took a long breath, then another. "Hera wants to become a lictor," she said. She would do anything to become a lictor. She'd easily have killed Dulcinea's cavalier if she thought it would help her become a lictor. Nothing else matters to her. I know that now. In the last couple days, I sometimes thought... Gideon did not finish that sentence, which would have been that she had stopped making it her top priority. Palamedes said very gently, "You really should not need me to tell you that an 11-year-old isn't responsible for the suicides of 3 grown adults." "Of course I'm responsible," said Gideon disgustedly. "I made it happen." "Yes," said Palamedes. "If you hadn't told Harrow's parents about the door, they would not have made the decision to end their lives. You inarguably caused it, but cause by itself is an empty concept. The choice to get up in the morning, the choice to have a hot breakfast or a cold one, the choice to do something 30 seconds faster or 30 seconds slower, those choices cause all sorts of things to happen. That doesn't make you responsible. Here's a confession for you. I killed Magnus and Abigail." Gideon blinked at him. "If, the second I stepped off my shuttle," said the suddenly revealed double murderer blithely, "I had snatched Cam's dagger and put it straight through Teacher's throat, the literal trial could never have begun. There'd have been an uproar. The cohort would have arrived, I'd have been dragged away, and everyone else would have been sent safe back home. Because I didn't kill Teacher, the trial began. And because the trial began, Magnus Quinn and Abigail Pent are dead. So, I did it. It's my fault. All I ask is that you put some pen and flimsy in my cell so I can start on my memoirs." Gideon blinked a couple more times. "No, hold up. That's stupid. They're not the same." "I don't see why not," said the necromancer. "We both made decisions that led to bad things happening." She rubbed at the bridge of her nose. "Octokizaron said you guys loved to mess with what words mean." "The Eighth House thinks there's right and there's wrong," said Palamedes wearily. "And by a series of happy coincidences, they always end up being right." "Look, Nav, you ratted out your childhood nemesis to get her in trouble. You didn't kill her parents, and she shouldn't hate you like you did. And you shouldn't hate you like you did." He was peering at her through his spectacles. "Hey," she objected lamely, "I never said I hated myself." "Evidence," he said, "outweighs testimony." Awkwardly, and a bit brusquely, he took her hand. He squeezed it. They were both obviously embarrassed by this, but Gideon did not let go. Not when she rummaged in the pocket of her robe with her other hand, and not when she passed over the scrumpled-up piece of flimsy that had bewildered her for so long. He unscrumpled it, and read without reaction. She squeezed his hand like an oath, or a threat. "This is from a Lictor lab," he said eventually. "Isn't it?" "Yeah," she admitted. "Is it... I mean, is it real?" He looked at her. "It's nearly 10,000 years old, if that's what you mean." "Well, I'm not," she said. "So, what the fuck, basically?" "The ultimate question," he agreed, returning his attention to the flimsy. "Can I borrow this? I'd like to look at it properly." "Do not show it to anyone else," Gideon said, without really knowing why. Something about her name being on this ancient piece of garbage felt as dangerous as a live grenade. "I'm serious. It stays between us." "I swear on my cavalier," he said. "You can't even show her." They were interrupted by six short knocks on the door, followed by six long. Both sprang up to pull apart the interlaced lattice of deadbolts. Camilla came through, and with her, upright and calm, was Harrow. For one wacky moment, Gideon thought that she and Camilla had been holding hands, and that today was one huge rash of inter-household hand-fondling, but then she realized that their wrists were cuffed together. Camilla was nobody's fool, though how she'd cuffed Harrow was going to be a tale of terror for another day. Gideon did not look at her, and Harrow did not look at Gideon. Gideon very slowly put her hand on her sword, but for nothing. Harrow was looking at Palamedes. She expected pretty much anything, but she didn't expect him to say, "Nonagesimus, why didn't you tell me?" "I didn't trust you," she said simply. "My original theory was that you'd done it. Septimus wasn't capable on her own, and it didn't seem far-fetched that you were working in concert."
"Will you believe me when I say we aren't?"
"Yes," she said, "because if you were that good, you would have killed my cavalier already. I hadn't even intended to hurt him, Sextus. The head fell off the moment I pushed."
"What?"
"Then we go," said Palamedes. "We get everyone. We talk to her. I won't have any more conversations in the dark or doubting of my intentions."
Gideon said helplessly, "Someone enlighten me. I am just a poor cavalier." But nobody paid her the slightest damn bit of attention, even though she had her hand very forbiddingly on her sword. Hera was ignoring her entirely in favour of Palamedes, and she was saying, "I wasn't sure you'd be willing to go that far, even for the truth." Palamedes looked at her with an expression as grey and airless as the ocean outside the window.
"Then you do not know me, Harrow Hark."
They all crowded into Dulcinea's little hospital room. It was them and the priest with the salt-and-pepper braid, who scuttled out as though affrighted as they lined the room in stony array. The whole gang had arrived for party times. Palamedes had sent for all the survivors, though considering their current group-wide interest in killing one another, the fact that they had bothered coming was nothing short of a miracle. The second stood against the wall, their jackets less creased than their faces. Ianthe and Coronabeth sat fussily crowded up on each other's knees, with their cavalier close behind. Silas stood inside the door. Colum stood just behind him. And if anyone had wanted to take them all out then and there, it would have been as simple as shutting the door and letting them all asphyxiate on Liberius Turn's pomade. It seemed so strange that this was now all of them. The necromancer of the seventh house was propped up on a bundle of fat cushions, looking calm and transparent. With every stridorous breath, her shoulders shook, but her hair was perfectly brushed and her nightgown nightmarishly frilly. She had in her lap the box that contained Protesilaus's head, and when she drew it gently out, wholly unspoiled, as if he were still alive, there were several indrawn breaths. Hers was not among them.
"My poor boy,"
she said sincerely. I'll never be able to put him back together now. Who took him apart? He's a wreck.
Palamedes steepled his fingers and leaned forward, greyly intent. Lady Septimus, Duchess of Rhodes, he said very formally, I put to you, before everyone here, that this man was dead before you arrived, by shuttle at the first house, and appeared alive only through deep flesh magic. There was an immediate hubbub, uncalmed by his impatient, be-quiet gestures and the shoving of his spectacles up his nose. Among the collective mutters, Ianthe Tridentarius's acid drool was loudest.
Well, this is the only interesting thing she's ever done.
Nearly as piercing was Captain Deuteros. Impossible! He's been with us for weeks!
It's not impossible at all, said Dulcinea herself.
She had been gravely meeting Protesilaus's murky stare, as though trying to find something out, and now she settled the head on her lap.
The Seventh House have been perfecting the way of the beguiling corpse for years and years and years. It's just not entirely allowed.
It is unholy, said Silas flatly.
So is soul-siphoning, my child, she said in tones of deliberately celestial sweetness. And it's not unholy. It's entirely useful and blameless. Just not when you do it like this, which is the very old way. The Seventh aren't just soul-stoppers and mummifiers. Yes, Pro was dead before we even landed.
Gideon said, just as flatly as Silas, Why? Those enormous flower-blue eyes turned to Gideon as though she were the only person in the room. There was no laughter in them, or else Gideon might have started to yell. Suddenly, the dying necromancer seemed enormously old, not with wrinkles, but with the sheer dignity and quiet with which she sat there, totally serene.
This competition caught out my house, she said boldly. Let me tell you the story. Dulcinea Septimus was never intended to be here, Gideon the Ninth. They would have preferred she be laid up at home and have another 6 months wrung out of her. It's an old story of the house, but there wasn't another necromantic heir, and there was a very good Cavalier Primary. So even if the necromantic heir was one bad cold away from full lung collapse, it was thought that he might even the odds. But then he had an accident.
Dulcinea fretted the dull hair of the head with her fingertips, then smoothed it out as if it were a doll's.
Hypothetically, if you were the Seventh House, and all your fortunes were now represented in two dead bodies, one breathing a little bit more than the other, wouldn't you consider something far-fetched? Let's say, by utilizing the way of the beguiling corpse, and hoping that nobody noticed that your house was DOA. I'm sorry for deceiving you, but I'm not sorry I came.
That doesn't add up.
Harrow was stiff as concrete. Her eyes were huge and dark, and though only Gideon could tell, very agitated.
The spell you're talking about is not within the range of a normal necromancer, Septimus. Impossible for a necromancer in their prime, let alone a dying woman.
A dying woman is the perfect necromancer, said Ianthe.
I wish I could get rid of that idea. Maybe for the final 10 minutes, said Palamedes. The technical fact that dying enhances your necromancy is vitiated considerably by the fact that you can't make any use of it. You might have access to a very personal source of thanagy, but considering your organs are shutting down...
It's not possible, insisted Harrow, words hard and clipped in her mouth.
You seem to know a lot about it. Well, I put it to you. Would it be possible for all the heads of the Seventh House, said Dulcinea calmly, adepts of the perfect death, a Seventh House mystic secret, one that's been ours forever, working all in concert?
Perhaps initially, but...
King Undead!
dying," said Silas, primly disgusted. "It was a conspiracy."
"Oh, sit on it," said Dulcinea. "I know all about you and your house, Master Silas Octokizeron. The Emperor himself never bothered to speak out against beguiling corpsehood, but he did say that siphoning was the most dangerous thing any house had ever thought up, and ought only to be done with the siphoner in cuffs."
"That does not mitigate the penalty for performing a necromantic act of transgression."
"I've no interest in meeting out the justice of the tome," said Captain Deuteros gruffly. "I know that's the Eighth House's prerogative, but at the same time, Master Octokizeron, we cannot afford this right now."
"A woman who would be party to this kind of magic," said Silas, "might be party to anything."
"The woman who was party to that kind of magic, and therefore may be party to anything, opened her mouth to speak, but instead had a coughing fit that seemed to start at her toes and go all the way up. Her spine arched, she bleated, and then began to moistly choke to death. Her face turned so grey that for a moment Gideon was convinced the Eighth House was doing something to her, but it was a block of phlegm rather than her soul being sucked out. Palamedes went for her, as did Camilla. He turned her over on her side, and she did something awful and complicated with her finger inside Dulcinea's mouth. The head on her lap went rolling and was caught only by the quick reflexes of Princess Ianthe, who cupped it between her hands like an exotic butterfly.
"What do you want, Octokizeron?" said the captain in the wake of this, stone-faced. "Room confinement? A death sentence? Both are uncharacteristically easy to fulfill in this instance."
"I understand your point," said Silas. "I do not agree with it. I will take my leave, madam. This is not interesting to me any more."
His exit was arrested by his cavalier, as brown and as careworn as ever, standing between him and the doorway. Colum did not really seem to notice his necromancer's attempts to leave.
"The furnace," he said shortly. "If we've got his head, what's in the furnace?"
Dulcinea, grey and squirming, managed. "What did you find in the fur—" before Palamedes slapped her on the back, at which point she coughed up what looked like a ball of bloody twigs. The third turned their faces away. Captain Deuteros did not. Maybe she'd seen worse. She gestured to her lieutenant, who had removed the head, none too gently, from Ianthe's fascinated gaze, and was boxing it up as though it were an unwanted meal. The captain moved closer to Harrow and Gideon and demanded,
"Who found him?"
"I did," said Harrow, casually failing to provide any details on how. "I took the head because I couldn't readily transport the body. The body has since disappeared through unknown means, though I've got my suspicions. The skull's mine by finder's rights."
"Ninth, the head is going in the morgue where it belongs," said the captain. "You don't have carrion rights over found murders, and today is not the day when I'll countenance your house taking bones that don't belong to it."
"I agree with Judith," said Corona. She had pushed her twin off her thigh and was looking a bit green around her lovely gills. She also looked uncharacteristically tired and careworn, though she managed to pull this off with a certain pensive loveliness to the fine crinkles at her eyes and mouth. "Today isn't the day when we start to use one another's bodies, or tomorrow, or ever. We're not barbarians." "Sheer prevarication," remarked her sister to nobody in particular. "Some people will do anything to get ahead." Everyone ignored her, even Gideon, who found herself trembling like a leaf. Harrowhark said merely, "The furnace bones are still mine to identify."
"You can utilize the morgue all you like," said the captain dismissively. "But the bodies aren't your property, Reverend Daughter. That goes for the warden, that goes for everybody. Do I make myself clear, or shall I repeat?"
"Understood," said Palamedes.
"Understood," said the Reverend Daughter, in the tones of someone who neither understood nor intended to. Silas had not left.
"In that case," he said, I consider it my bounden duty to take watch over the morgue in case the Ninth forgets what constitutes defilement of the bodies. I will take the remains. You may find me there.
Captain Deuteros did not roll her eyes. She gestured to her lieutenant, who handed over the box. Silas took it and winced faintly, and then passed it to his nephew. Gruesome parcel secured, they finally turned and left. The third were already starting to bitch.
"I always said he didn't look right," said the cavalier.
"You said no such thing," said the first twin.
"At no point did you ever say that," said the second twin.
"Excuse you, I did."
Captain Deuteros cleared her throat over the fresh internecine squabbling.
"Does anyone else want to take this opportunity to admit that they're already dead or a flesh construct or other relevant object? Anyone?"
Palamedes had been wiping Dulcinea's mouth very gently with a white cloth. He laid his hand at her neck. She was still. Her face was now the thin blue-white colour of Canaan House's milk, and for a moment Gideon expected him to add her to the already dead list. She would decide to go out with an audience, with her hair done, and with her miserable secrets revealed. Now she knew that Dulcinea had always been alone, carrying on an even greater farce than Gideon's, knowing the impossibility of the odds. But the dying necromancer sucked in a sudden, rattling, popped balloon breath, her whole body surging in spasm. Gideon's heart started up again. Before she could move, Palamedes was there, and with terrible tenderness, as though they were alone in the room and the world alike, he kissed the back of Dulcinea's hand. Gideon looked away, blushing with a shame she didn't interrogate, and found Teacher in the doorway with his hands folded before his gaudy rainbow sash. Nobody had heard him enter.
"Maybe later, Lady Judith," he said.
She said, "You'll need to contact the Seventh House and have her sent back home. It's morally and legally out of the question to leave her this way. Is that clear?"
"I cannot," said Teacher. "There was only ever a single communications channel in Canaan House, my lady, and I cannot call her house on it. I cannot call the Fifth, nor the Fourth, nor now the Seventh. This is part of the sacred silence we keep. There will be an end to all this, and there will be a reckoning, but Lady Septimus will stay with us until the last."
The Second's adept had stopped all of a sudden. For a moment, Gideon thought she was going to lose her carefully buttoned rag, but she cocked her dark head and said,
"Lieutenant?"
"Ready,"
said Marta the Second, and they both marched out as though they were in parade formation. They did not give the rest of the room a backward glance. Teacher looked at the tableau before him. The bed, the blood, the third. Palamedes, still clutching Dulcinea's fingers within his own, and Dulcinea out cold.
"How long does Lady Septimus have?" he asked. "I can no longer tell."
"Days. Weeks, if we're lucky," said Palamedes bluntly.
Dulcinea made a little hiccuping noise on the bed that sounded half like a giggle and half like a sigh.
"That's if we keep the windows open and her airways clear. Breathing recycle at Rhodes probably took 10 years off her life. She's been sitting on the brink without shifting one way or the other. The woman has the stamina of a steam engine, and all we can do is keep her comfortable and see if she doesn't decide to pull through."
Harrow said to him slowly,
"Undoing the Cavalier's bodywork should have killed her. It would have been an incredible shock to her system."
"Spreading it between multiple casters may have diluted the feedback."
"That is not remotely how it works," said Ianthe.
"Oh, God, here comes the expert," Nibirius said.
"Babs," said Ianthe's sister hurriedly, "you're getting hangry. Let's go find some food." Gideon watched her necromancer's gaze fix on Ianthe Tridentarius. Ianthe did not notice, or affected not to notice,
Her eyes were as pale and purple and calm as they ever were, but Harrowhark was quivering like a maggot next to a dead duck. As the third traipsed out, as noisy as if they were leaving a play, not a sick room, Harrow's eyes went with them. Gideon said aloud, "Hey, Palamedes, do you need someone to stay with her?"
"I will," said Teacher, before Palamedes could respond. "I will move my bed here. I will not leave her alone again. Whenever I must leave my post, one of the other priests will take my place. I can do that much, at least. I am not afraid, nor do I have better things to do with my time. Whereas I am very much afraid you do."
Gideon allowed herself a lingering look at Dulcinea, who made for a more beguiling corpse than her stolid dead cavalier ever did, lying on the bed looking nearly transparent with streaks of drying, bloodied mucus on her chin. She wanted to help. But out of the corner of her eye she saw Harrow moving out of the doorway and into the corridor, staring after the disappearing third, and she steeled herself to say, "Then we're out. Can you let us know if anything changes?"
"Someone will come for you," said Teacher gently.
"Cool. Palamedes?" He met her eye. He had taken off his glasses and was cleaning them with one of his innumerable handkerchiefs. "Ninth," he said. "If she were capable of anything, in order to become a lictor, don't you think she'd be one already? If she really wanted to watch the world burn, wouldn't we all be alight?" "Stop flattering her, but..." "Thanks," said Gideon, and she darted off into the corridor after Harrow.
Chapter 31. In the corridor, her necromancer was staring distantly down the passageway at the disappearing hems of the third. Her brow had furrowed a wrinkle into her paint. Gideon had intended to... She had intended to do a lot of things, but Harrow left her no opening for the actions she'd planned and offered none of the answers she'd wanted. She simply turned in a swish of black cloth and said, "Follow me." Gideon had prepared beforehand a "fuck you" salvo so long and so loud that Harrow would have to be taken away to be killed, but then Harrow added, "Please?" This "please" convinced Gideon to follow her in silence. She had more or less expected Harrow to lead with, "What were you doing in my closet?" At which point Gideon might well have shaken her until the teeth in her head and the teeth in her pockets all rattled. Harrowhark swept down the stairs two at a time, the treads creaking in panic as they went down the grand flight that led them to the atrium. From there, down one corridor, down another, one left, and then down the steps to the training rooms. Harrow ignored the tapestry that would have taken them to the hidden corridor and the ransacked Lictor laboratory where Jean-Marie had died, and instead pushed open the big dark doors to the pool. Once there, she tossed down two grubby knuckles from her pockets. A substantial skeleton sprang from each, unfurling. They stood before the door, linked elbows, and held it shut. She scattered another handful of chips like pale grain. Skeletons rose, forming and expanding the bone as though bubbling up from it. They made themselves a perimeter around the whole room, pressing the knobbles of their spines against the old ceramic tile and standing to attention. Shoulder to shoulder they stood, as though bodyguards or hideous chaperones. Hera turned to face Gideon, and her eyes were as black and inexorable as a gravity collapse. "The time has come." She took a deep breath, and then she undid the catches to her robes, and they fell away from her thin shoulders to puddle around her ankles on the floor. "To tell you everything," she said.
"Oh, thank God for that," said Gideon hysterically, profoundly embarrassed at how her heart rate had spiked. "Shut up and get in the pool." This was so unanticipated that she didn't bother to question or to complain or even to hesitate. Gideon unhooked her robe and hood and pulled off her shoes,
unstrapped her rapier and the belt that held her gauntlet. Harris seemed ready to enter the greenly lapping waves wearing her trousers and shirt, so Gideon figured, oh well, what the hell, and made the plunge almost fully clothed. She jumped in recklessly. Tidal waves exploded outward at her passing, peppering the stone sides of the pool with droplets gushing and foaming. The seamy, distasteful feeling of water seeping through her underwear hit her all at once. Gideon spluttered and ducked her head beneath and spat out a mouthful of liquid that was warm as blood. After a moment's consideration, Harrow stepped in too, walking off the side carelessly, slipping beneath the water like a clean black knife. She disappeared beneath the surface, then emerged, gasping, spluttering in a way that ruined everything about the portentous entrance. She faced Gideon and trod water, flapping her arms a little before she managed to get her toes touching the bottom. "Are we in here for a reason?" Their voices echoed. "The ninth house has a secret, Nav," said Harrow. She sounded calm and measured and frank in a way she'd never been before. "Only my family knows of it, and even we could never discuss it, unless, this was my mother's rule, we were immersed in salt water. We kept a ceremonial pool for the purpose, hidden from the rest of the house. It was cold and deep, and I hated every moment I was in it. But my mother is dead, and I find now that, if I really am to betray my family's most sacred trust, I am obliged at the least to keep intact her rule." Gideon blinked.
"Oh, shit," she said. "You really meant it.
This is it. This is go time."
"This is go time," agreed Harrow Hark.
Gideon swept both of her hands through her hair, trickles going down the back of her neck and into her sodden collar. Eventually, all she said was, "Why?"
"The reasons are multitudinous," said her necromancer.
Her paint was wearing off in the water. She looked like a grey picture of a melting skeleton.
"I had intended to let you know some of it before, an expurgated version. And then you looked in my closet. If I had told you my suspicions about Septimus's meat puppet on the first day, none of this would have happened."
"The first day?"
"Griddle," said Harrow. "I have not puppeted my own parents around for 5 years and learned nothing."
Anger did seep into Gideon then, along with a couple more liters of salt water.
"Why the hell didn't you tell me when you killed him?"
"I didn't kill him," said Harrow Hark sharply. "Someone else did. Blade through the heart, from what I saw. Though I only got a few minutes to look before I had to run. I only had to push the theorem the most basic bit before he came apart. I took the head and left when I thought I heard someone coming. This was the night after we completed the entropy field challenge."
"No, you monster's ass," said Gideon coldly. "I mean, why didn't you tell me you'd killed him before you sent Jean-Marie Chateur and her necromancer down to the facility to look for the guy who was in a box in your closet? Why didn't you take the moment to say, I don't know, let's not send two children downstairs to get fucked up by a huge bone creature?"
Harrow exhaled.
"I panicked," she said. "At the time, I thought I was sending you down a blind tunnel, and that the real danger was Sextus and Septimus, that either one might ambush you, and that the sensible solution was to take them both on myself. My plan was to get you clear of a necromantic duel. At the time, I even thought it elegant."
"Nona Jezimus, all you had to do was delay. Tell me you were freaking out. All you had to do was say that Dulcinea's calf was a mummy man."
"I had reason to believe," said Harrow, "that you would trust her more than you trusted me."
This answer contorted Gideon's face into her best, "Are you fucking kidding me?" expression. Opposite, Harrow smoothed her forehead out with her thumbs, which took away another significant portion of skeleton.
"I thought you were compromised," she continued waspishly. "I assumed you would assume that I dismantled the puppet as an act of bad faith and go straight to the seventh. I wanted to do enough research to present you with a cut-and-dry case." I had no idea what it would mean for the fourth house. The ninth is deep in their blood debt, and I am undone by the expense. I did not want to hurt you, Griddle. I didn't want to disturb your equilibrium.
Harrow, said Gideon,
if my heart had a dick, you would kick it. I did not want to alienate you more than I already had, and then it seemed as though we were on a more even footing, said Harrow, who was stumbling in a way Gideon had never before witnessed. It looked as though she were ransacking drawers in her brain, trying to find the right set of words to wear. It was too tenuous to risk, and then...
Too tenuous to risk?
Harrow, said Gideon again, more slowly. If I hadn't gone to Palamedes, and I nearly didn't go to Palamedes, I would have waited for you in our rooms with my sword drawn, and I would have gone for you. I was so convinced you were behind everything, that you'd killed Jean-Marie and Isaac, Magnus and Abigail.
I didn't.
I never have, said Harrow. And I know. You would have killed me. Or vice versa. This surprised her into silence. The wavelets sploshed gently at the tiled edges of the pool. Gideon kicked off the bottom and fluttered her feet back and forth, bobbing, her shirt billowing out with water.
Okay, she said eventually.
Question time. Who did all the murders?
Nav.
I mean it. What's happening? Is Canaan House haunted or what? What? Who killed the fourth and the fifth?
Her necromancer also pulled her feet up from the bottom and floated, momentarily, chin deep in green salt water. Her eyes were narrowed in thought.
I can't say, she said. Sorry, that's not a fruitful line of inquiry. We are being pursued by revenants, or it's all part of the challenge, or one or more of us is picking off the others. The murders of the fifth and the fourth may be connected, or not. The bone fragments found in everyone's wounds don't match, naturally, but I believe their very particle formation points to the same type of necromantic construction, no matter what Sexter says about topological resonance and skeletal archetype theory.
Harrow, don't make me drown myself.
My conclusion, if the murders are linked, and if some adept, rather than a revenant force or the facility itself, is behind the construct you saw, then it is one of us, said Harrow. We're the only living beings in Canaan House. That means the suspect list is the Tridentarii, Sextus, Octokaiseron, the second, or myself. And I haven't discounted Teacher and the priests. Septimus has something of an alibi.
Yes, being nearly dead, said Gideon.
Harrowhark said, rather grudgingly. I've downgraded her in some respects, logically, judging by ability and mind and the facility to combine both in service to an end. It's Palamedes Sextus and his cavalier. She shook her head as Gideon opened her mouth to protest. No, I realize neither has, as you might put it, a fucking motive. A logical conclusion is worth very little if I don't have all the facts. Then there's Teacher, and the Lictor laboratories, and the rules. Why those theorems? What powers them? Why was the fourth cavalier killed, but you left alive?
These were all questions that Gideon had privately asked the dead of night many times since Jean-Marie had died. She let her shoulders slide back into the water until it was cold up to the backs of her ears, staring at the single fluorescing bar that swung above the pool. Her body floated weightless in a puddle of yellow light. She could have asked Harrow anything. She could have asked about the bomb that had taken Ortus Nigenad's life instead of hers, or she could have asked about her whole entire existence, why it had happened and for what reason. Instead, she found herself asking, "What do you know about the conditioner pathogen that bumped off all the kids, the one that happened when I was little, before you were born?" The silence was terrible. It lasted for such a long time that she wondered if Harrow had slyly drowned herself in the interim until... "It didn't happen before I was born," said the other girl, sounding very unlike herself. Or at least, that's not precise enough. It happened before I was even conceived. That's unwholesomely specific. It's important. My mother needed to carry a child to term, and that child needed to be a necromancer to fill the role of true heir to the locked tomb. But as necromancers themselves, they found the process doubly difficult. We hardly had access to the fetal care technology that the other houses do. She had tried and failed already. She was getting old. She had one chance, and she couldn't afford chance. Gideon said, "You can't just control whether or not you're carrying a necro." "Yes, you can," said Harrow, "if you have the resources and are willing to pay the price of using them." The hairs on the back of Gideon's neck rose wetly. "Harrow," she said slowly, "by resources, are you saying..."
200 children, said Harrow Hark tiredly. "From the ages of 6 weeks to 18 years, they needed to all die more or less simultaneously for it to work. My great-aunts measured out the organophosphates after weeks of mathematics. Our house pumped them through the cooling system." From somewhere beneath the pool, a filter made blurting sounds as it recycled the spill-off. Harrow said, "The infants alone generated enough thanergy to take out the entire planet. Babies always do, for some reason." Gideon couldn't hear this. She held her knees to the chest and let herself go under just for a moment. The water sluiced over her head and through her hair. Her ears roared, then popped. When she pushed above the surface again, the noise of her heartbeat thumping through her skull was like an explosion.
"Say something," said Harrow Hark.
"Gross," said Gideon dully. "Ick. The worst. What can I say to that? What the fuck can I say to all that?"
"It let me be born," said the necromancer. "And I was me. And I have been aware since I was very young about how I was created. I am exactly 200 sons and daughters of my house, Griddle. I am the whole generation of the ninth. I came into this world a necromancer at the expense of Dreaber's future, because there is no future without me." Gideon's stomach churned, but her brain was more urgent than her nausea.
"Why leave me, though?" she demanded. "They murdered the rest of the house, but they left me off the list?"
There was a pause.
"We didn't," said Harrow.
"What?"
"You were meant to die, Griddle, along with all the others. You inhaled nerve gas for 10 full minutes. My great-aunts went blind just from releasing it, and you weren't affected, even though you were just 2 cots away from the vent. You just didn't die. My parents were terrified of you for the rest of their lives."
The Reverend Father and Mother hadn't found her unnatural because of how she'd been born. They'd found her unnatural because of how she hadn't died. And all the nuns and all the priests and all the anchorites of the cloister had taken the cue from them, not knowing that it was because Gideon was just some smothered and unfortunate animal who had still been alive the next day. The world revolved as Harrow floated closer. Memory took Pelliamina's steady gaze and refocused the way it slid through and over Gideon from contempt to dread. It took the stentorious, short-changed breath when Priam Hark saw her and breathed it again in horror, not in repugnance. One small kid who, to 2 adults, was a walking reminder of the day they had chosen to mortgage the future of their house. No wonder she had hated the huge, dark doors of Dreaber. Beyond that portal lurked the used-up, emptied-out shades of a bunch of kids whose main sin in life was that they'd been good batteries.
"And do you think you're worth it?" she asked bluntly.
Next to her, Harrow didn't flinch. "If I became a lictor," she said meditatively, "and renewed my house, and made it great again, and greater than it ever was,
and justified its existence in the eyes of God the Emperor, if I made my whole life a monument to those who died to ensure that I would live and live powerfully.
Gideon waited.
Of course I wouldn't be worth it, Hera said scornfully. I'm an abomination. The whole universe ought to scream whenever my feet touch the ground. My parents committed a necromantic sin that we ought to have been torpedoed into the center of Dominicus for. If any of the other houses knew of what we'd done, they would destroy us from orbit without a second's thought. I am a war crime.
She stood up. Gideon watched as sheets of seawater slicked down her shoulders, her hair a wet black cap on her skull, her skin sheening grey and green from the waves. All the paint had rubbed off, and Herohart looked thin and haggard and no older than Jean-Marie Chateau. But I'd do it again, said the war crime. I'd do it again if I had to. My parents did it because there was no other way. They didn't even know. I had to be a necromancer of their bloodline, Nav, because only a necromancer can open the locked tomb. Only a powerful necromancer can roll away the stone. I found that only the perfect necromancer can pass through those wards and live and approach the sarcophagus. Gideon's toes found purchase, and she stood chest deep in water, goosebumped all over from the cold. What happened to praying that the tomb be shut forever and the rock never be rolled away? My parents didn't understand either, and that's why they died, said Harrowhark. That's why, when they knew I'd done it, that I'd rolled away the stone and that I'd gone through the monument and that I had seen the place where the body was buried, they thought I'd betrayed God. The locked tombs meant to house the one true enemy of the King Undying, Nav, something older than time, the cost of the resurrection, the beast that he defeated once but can't defeat twice, the abyss of the first, the death of the Lord. He left the grave with us for our safekeeping, and he trusted the ones who built the tomb a myriad ago to wall themselves up with the corpse and die there. But we didn't. And that's how the ninth house was made.
Gideon remembered Silas Octochizeron. The eighth never forgot that the ninth was never meant to be.
Are you telling me that when you were 10 years old, 10 years old, you busted the lock on the tomb, broke into an ancient grave and made your way past hideous old magic to look at a dead thing, even though your parents told you it'd start the apocalypse?
Yes, said Hera Hark.
Why?
There was another pause, and Hera looked down into the water. Limned by electric light, her pupils and her irises appeared the same colour. I was tired of being 200 corpses, she said simply. I was old enough to know how monstrous I was. I had decided to go and look at the tomb, and if I didn't think it was worth it, to go up the stairs, all the flights of the ninth house, open up an airlock, and walk. And walk.
She lifted her gaze.
She held Gideon's. But you came back instead, said Gideon. I'd told the Reverend Mother and the Reverend Father what I'd seen you do. I killed your parents.
What? My parents killed my parents. I should know. But I told them.
My parents killed themselves because they were frightened and ashamed, said Hera tightly. They thought it was the only honourable thing to do.
I think your parents must have been frightened and ashamed for a hell of a long time.
I'm not saying I didn't blame you. I did. It was much easier. I pretended for a long time that I could have saved them by talking to them and Mortis the Ninth. When you walked in, when you saw what you saw, when you saw what I had failed to do, I hated you because you saw what I didn't do. My mother and father weren't angry, Nav. They were very kind to me. They tied their own nooses, and then they helped me tie mine. I watched them help Mortis onto the chair. Mortis didn't even question it. He never did. But I couldn't do it. After all I had convinced myself I was ready to do, I made myself watch when my parents...
I could not do the slightest thing my house expected of me. Not even then. You're not the only one who couldn't die.
The waves lapped, tiny and quiet, around their clothes and their skins.
Hera, said Gideon, and her voice caught.
Harrow, I'm so bloody sorry.
Harrow's eyes snapped wide open. The whites blazed like plasma. The black rings were blacker than the bottom of Dreaba. She waded through the water, snatched Gideon's wet shirt in her fists, and shook her with more violence than Gideon had ever thought her muscularly capable of. Her face was livid in its hate. Her loathing was a mortar. It was combustion.
You apologize to me, she bellowed. You apologize to me now. You say that you're sorry when I have spent my life destroying you. You are my whipping girl. I hurt you because it was a relief. I exist because my parents killed everyone and relegated you to a life of abject misery. And they would have killed you too and not given it a second's goddamned thought. I have spent your life trying to make you regret that you weren't dead, all because I regretted I wasn't. I ate you alive, and you have the temerity to tell me that you're sorry.
There were flecks of spittle on Herohark's lips. She was retching for air.
I have tried to dismantle you, Gideon Nav. The Ninth House poisoned you. We trod you underfoot. I took you to this killing field as my slave. You refused to die, and you pity me. Strike me down. You've won. I've lived my whole wretched life at your mercy, yours alone, and God knows I deserve to die at your hand. You are my only friend. I am undone without you.
Gideon braced her shoulders against the weight of what she was about to do. She shared 18 years of living in the dark with a bunch of bad nuns. In the end, her job was surprisingly easy. She wrapped her arms around her own Nona Jessamus and held her long and hard, like a scream. They both went into the water, and the world went dark and salty. The Reverend Daughter fell calm and limp, as was natural for one being ritually drowned. But when she realized that she was being hugged, she thrashed as though her fingernails were being ripped from their beds. Gideon did not let go. After more than one mouthful of saline, they ended up huddled together in one corner of the shadowy pool, tangled up in each other's wet shirt sleeves. Gideon peeled Hera's head off her shoulder by the hair and beheld it, taking her inventory, her point-boned, hateful little face, her woeful black brows, the bloodless bow of her lips. She examined the disdainful set of the jaw, the panic in the starless eyes. She pressed her mouth to the place where Hero's nose met the bone of her frontal sinus, and the sound that Hero made embarrassed them both.
Too many words, said Gideon confidentially.
How about these? One flesh, one end, bitch.
The Ninth House necromancer flushed nearly black. Gideon tilted her head up and caught her gaze.
Say it, loser.
One flesh. One end, Hera repeated fumblingly, and then could say no more.
After what seemed like a very, very long time, her adept said,
Gideon, you need to promise me something.
Gideon wiped a thumb over her temple, tidied away a stringy lock of shadow-coloured hair. Hera shuddered.
I thought that this was all about me getting a bunch of concessions and you grovelling. But you called me Gideon, so shoot.
Hera said, in the event of my death, Gideon, if something ever does get the better of me, I need you to outlast me. I need you to go back to the Ninth House and protect the locked tomb. If I die, I need your duty not to die with me.
That is such a dick move, said Gideon reproachfully.
I know, said Hera. I know.
Hera, what the hell is in there that you'd ask that of me?
Her adept closed heavy-lidded eyes.
The
Beyond the doors, there's just the rock, she said. The rock and the tomb, surrounded by water. I won't bore you with the magic, or the locks, or the wards, or the barriers. Just know that it took me a year to walk 6 steps inside, and that it nearly killed me then. There's a blood ward bypass on the doors, which will only respond for the necromancer divine. But I knew there had to be an exploit, a way through for the true and devout tomb keeper. I knew in the end it had to open for me. The water's salt, and it's deep, and it moves with a tide that shouldn't exist. The sepulchre itself is small, and the tomb... Her eyes opened. A small, astonished smile creased her mouth. The smile transformed her face into an affliction of beauty that Gideon had heretofore managed to ignore. The tomb is stone and ice, Nav. Ice that never melts and stone that's even colder. And inside, in the dark, there's a girl.
A what? A girl, you yellow-eyed moron, said Harrowhark.
Her voice dropped to a whisper, and her head was dead weight in Gideon's hands. Inside the locked tomb is the corpse of a girl. They packed her in ice. She's frozen solid, and they laid a sword on her breast. Her hands are wrapped around the blade. There are chains around her wrists, coming out of her grave, and they go down into holes by each side of the tomb. And there are chains on her ankles that do the same, and there are chains around her throat. Nav, when I saw her face, I decided I wanted to live. I decided to live forever, just in case she ever woke up. Her voice had the quality of someone in a long dream. She stared through Gideon without looking at her, and Gideon gently took her hands away from Harrow's jaw. Instead, she sat back in the water, buoyed by the salt, her eyes starting to sting from it. They both floated there for a long time in amicable silence, until they pulled themselves up and sat, dripping on the side of the pool. The salt was crusting up their hair. Gideon reached over to take Harrow's hand. They sat there, wet through and uncomfortable, fingers curled into each other's in the half-light, the pool interminably lapping at the cool tiles that surrounded it. The skeleton stood in perfect silent ranks, not betraying themselves with even a creak of bone against bone. Gideon's brain moved and broke against itself like the tiny wavelets they had left.